morning. This is AM. I'm Tony Eastley. Iraq post Saddam Hussein was supposed to become a model for democracy and stability. Instead, 2 years after the US forces left, it's now racked by violence and instability. Fallujah, west of Baghdad, is largely under the control of Sunni militants from the Islamic State of Iraq and Syria, an al-Qaeda-backed group that wants to take over the whole region. The Islamic State in Iraq and the Levant, or ISIS as it's known, is worrying the US and its allies. More on that later. In Iraq, the violence centred around Fallujah has prompted Iraq's Prime Minister to tell people in the city, expel the militants or prepare for an all-out government assault. With more, here's Middle East correspondent Hayden Cooper.
As if the last 10 years of conflict weren't bad enough, residents of Fallujah and Ramadi in Iraq's west are fleeing again. Carloads of refugees have been trying to escape the cities, now in the hands of militants. We are from Ramadi, this man says. We're going to Karbala to get food and cooking gas. We are displaced. They're fleeing while they still have time. Militant tribes and Sunni extremists from the Islamic State of Iraq and Syria are trading threats with the government. In one video, armed and masked men from Fallujah issue a declaration. The revolutionaries of Fallujah tribes, they say, are resolved to punish those who are linked to the sectarian government. Iraq's Prime Minister Nouri al-Maliki has now responded with a threat of his own. He's delivered a televised statement urging the people of Fallujah to expel the terrorists or prepare for an armed military assault. Amid the fighting already underway, government troops are reported to have now surrounded Fallujah and reinforcements are arriving from Baghdad. According to this lieutenant, the tight security measures that we take today are because of the situation in Anbar to avoid security deterioration or violence in Baghdad. God willing, we are at the service of the people and we vow to protect the homeland. Government forces are talking tough, claiming that 2 or 3 days is all they need to regain control in Ramadi and Fallujah. But as each hour passes, the black flags of ISIS continue to fly in the streets of Anbar. This is Hayden Cooper reporting for AM.
The United States says it's in close contact with the Iraqi government, but it's already made clear that it has no plans to send American troops to assist. North America correspondent Michael Vincent reports Washington has said it will, though, speed up delivery of hardware, including drones, that have proved successful.
The US pulled its soldiers out of Iraq just over 2 years ago, but memories are still fresh for Democrats like Brian Schweitzer.
We made a very big mistake there. It cost us a lot of blood and a lot of treasure, and we ought not make those mistakes in the future.
The Obama administration has been criticized by senior Republicans for not leaving a residual force in Iraq to help with security. But the White House is adamant nothing has changed. Spokesman Jay Carney.
I've heard members of Congress suggest this, but if members were suggesting that there should be American troops fighting and dying in Fallujah today, they should say so.
The White House says it is in discussions with the Iraqis about plans of attack, and it says it is increasing its delivery of hardware to target the al-Qaeda affiliate group.
We're working closely with the Iraqis to develop a holistic strategy to isolate the al-Qaeda affiliated groups, and we have seen some early successes in Ramadi, as you know, where tribal forces and police, with the Iraqi army providing support, appear to have isolated ISIL in pockets of the city.
Jay Carney says the situation is fluid and it's too early to tell if that strategy has been successful, but he says further Hellfire missile shipments will be sent soon.
These missiles are one small element of that holistic strategy, but they have been proven effective at denying ISIL the safe haven zones that it has sought to establish in western Iraq. I can add that in addition to those Hellfire missiles, through our FMS program, we will also be providing 10 Scan Eagle surveillance UAVs in the upcoming weeks and 48 Raven surveillance UAVs later this year.
That's in addition to helicopters that were delivered in December. But former American Ambassador Nicholas Burns says the US is relying on diplomacy to solve many of the problems in Iraq, Syria, and Lebanon.
But what's most worrisome is that for a long time now, people have been predicting that the Syrian civil war might produce a wider war. We're beginning to see that happen, particularly in Iraq and Lebanon, where these Sunni and Shia passions and the divisions between them are now playing out in all three countries. And that's a big problem for the Arabs as well as the United States.
The events in Iraq have also renewed focus on Afghanistan, where the US is yet to finalise its bilateral security agreement with the government of Hamid Karzai. This is Michael Vincent in Washington for AM.
Bangladesh's recent election has been labelled a farce, and there are fears that it could ultimately strengthen the hand of extremist groups in the strife-torn country. Prime Minister Sheikh Hasina's Awami League easily won re-election, especially after the main opposition parties boycotted the poll. There were violent clashes between police and political protesters, and that's led to concerns that opposition to the government is becoming radicalised. South Asia correspondent Michael Edwards with this report.
The ruling party, the Awami League, had the election in the bag even before a single vote was cast. Most of its candidates were elected unopposed, after the country's main opposition parties boycotted the election. Many Bangladeshis feel as though this makes the result invalid.
I see in the newspapers that there was massive fraud in the Dhaka polling stations and that many people were killed. To me, this is not an acceptable election.
And the anger continues to rise. Around 20 people died in clashes between security forces and protesters on election day. Dozens were killed in the weeks preceding it. 30 or so polling booths were also set on fire.
The election was supposed to be peaceful, but it was not so. There were not a lot of voters in the polling booths.
The Prime Minister Sheikh Hasina went ahead with the polls after refusing to bow to opposition demands to have them organised by a neutral caretaker administration. Sheikh Hasina's bitter political rival, the leader of the opposition Bangladesh Nationalist Party, the former Prime Minister Khaled Azia, has spent most of the past few months under virtual house arrest. Along with the violence, the election was also marred by poor voter turnout. Osman Farooq, a senior leader of the BNP, calls the whole situation a disgrace.
This election commission is absolutely spineless. It's subservient to the government. It's a puppet of the political party.
Complicating the situation was the government's move to execute an Islamist leader for his role in opposing independence from Pakistan in 1971. Abdul Qadir Mollah was hanged last month for his role in a 1971 massacre during Bangladesh's War of Independence. His death sparked riots as supporters of his party, Jamaat-e Islami, took to the streets. JI has never had widespread public support because of its links to Pakistan. But the concern for many is that this could change because of the government's suppression of its political opponents. General A.M. Munir Usman is the head of the Institute for Peace and Security Studies based in Dhaka.
Radical elements in Bangladesh will come out and spread their wings because democratic process or the due process will be halted by the process of election, which is not credible.
All the major opposition parties are now holding a nationwide strike. Analysts such as General Munir Usman are fearful the violence could escalate.
There is a general strike that has been called for today and tomorrow, and I presume that the violence that we have seen so far in the last couple of months will continue or even may increase. As you can see that since the election dates were declared in the last week of October, something like 150 people lost their lives.
And the government isn't exactly striking a conciliatory note post the election. In a warning to its opponents, it's vowed to eliminate militancy that it says is being generated by Islamic extremists. This is Michael Edwards reporting for AM.
And you are listening to AM around Australia, where it's 19 and a half minutes past 7. To follow us on Twitter, search the handle AM World Today PM. And the audio and transcripts of our stories can be found on our website. Just type ABC space AM into your search engine and follow the links. Still to come on the program, voters in the Riverside inner city of Brisbane vote for the replacement of Kevin Rudd and the WA heatwave. A new study has suggested ethnicity plays a role in determining how well a person can fight off a new flu strain. The study by researchers at the University of Melbourne has found that Indigenous Australians and Alaskans may be particularly vulnerable to a new flu virus that emerged in China last year. The researchers identified how genetic differences in a protein involved in a type of immune response means that people may vary in their ability to fight new flu strains. Alison Caldwell reports.
The H7N9 flu virus emerged in China in February last year. 137 people were infected and 45 people died. Health officials believe domestic birds are the source of the flu strain, and there are concerns H7N9 will return during the northern winter. Because it's a new flu strain, humans lack protective antibodies against the virus. A new study by researchers at the University of Melbourne suggests people may vary in their ability to mount a defence against the virus due to genetic differences. Lead author, Associate Professor Catherine Kajeska, explains.
We know from the previous studies that cellular immunity is more conserved and can provide universal immunity and recognize different strains of influenza. So if we have encountered previous influenza strains, we might have immunity to this novel H7N9 virus. We have found a significant level of similarity between the H7N9 strain and previously circulating influenza A viruses in the internal parts of the virus recognized by the killer T cells. This really depended on the genetic makeup of the individual. Based on our analysis, we estimated that it would be between 16 to 57% of the population that would have pre-existing T-cell immunity to give us some level of protection to the new H7N9 influenza virus.
But that's a massive difference, 16% to 57%.
That's correct. And we know that the populations which the T-cells would not work because of the genetic makeup would be indigenous people of Alaska and Australia.
The H1N1 pandemic in 2009 caused higher attack rates and death among indigenous populations in Australia and New Zealand. So did the Spanish flu in the early 20th century.
We observed really high adult mortalities, really up to 100% were reported in some isolated Alaskan villages. Similarly, as many as 10 to 20% of Indigenous Australians died of the influenza in 1919.
Professor Catherine Kajeska says it's hoped a universal T-cell vaccine can be developed to help protect people who may be particularly vulnerable to new flu strains such as H7N9.
What we propose is that the T-cell vaccine would be a component of the annual vaccine. It is what we call a universal immunity, which means it would give us some level of protection against several different strains and subtypes of influenza viruses.
The study has been published in the journal PNAS today.
Alison Caldwell. National politics is set to dominate the by-election in the former Prime Minister Kevin Rudd's electorate of Griffith. Voters in the Riverside inner city seat in Brisbane will be heading back to polling booths on the 8th of February. The Coalition's candidate, Dr. Bill Glasson, is running again after securing a 5.5% swing against the Prime Minister in September. But the chances of Dr. Glasson delivering the once safe Labor seat into the Coalition's hands are pretty slim. Melissa Clark reports.
The starting gun has been fired in the race for the seat of a former Prime Minister. Kevin Rudd's departure from politics marks the end of one of the most turbulent periods in recent political history, but the by-election campaign in his seat of Griffith is just starting, and it's shaping up as a local fight on national issues.
It's the first opportunity for them to pass judgment on the Abbott government.
Labor's candidate is lawyer Terry Butler.
Well, I think people will take this opportunity to send a message to Mr. Abbott and his government about their shambolic first 4 months in office.
The Coalition candidate, Dr. Bill Glasson, is banking on a rerun of the nationally successful Axe the Tax campaign.
There's legislation before the federal parliament in terms of repealing the carbon tax, and I call upon Mr. Shorten and the Labor Party to back that legislation.
Dr. Glasson was a star recruit for Queensland's Liberal National Party. The former head of the Australian Medical Association managed to turn a safe Labor prime ministerial seat into a marginal electorate. But the ABC's election analyst Anthony Green says it's unlikely he'll be able to repeat the feat and secure the extra 3% swing needed to put the seat in the government's hands.
If you go by history, Labor should retain the seat. It's been 90 years since a governing party took a seat off the opposition.
It's a history lesson Dr. Glasson is well aware of.
Obviously, in a by-election situation, it's always harder when you've got an incumbent, your own party in this incumbent government.
The ALP believes the recent debate over whether there should be a $6 fee for GP visits is damaging for Dr. Glasson, who has supported the idea, even though it's not coalition policy. Labor's Terry Butler.
There was no mention of any GP fees prior to the election only 4 months ago, but here we are in January and they're not ruling them out.
There's been no greater advocate for Medicare than Bill Glasson.
It's an argument that certainly has Bill Glasson on the defensive.
Listen, this proposal was a think tank. The government hasn't even looked at it, hasn't even considered it.
Greens candidate Jeff Ebbs suffered a 5.2% swing against him in the September poll. He's running again, hoping to reverse that result.
We'll be aiming to regain all of the ground that we lost in the September general election and hopefully get a bit more on top of that.
He's predicting voters will be more reluctant to support the micro-parties that were so successful in the general election.
The result where we've had micro-parties gaining Senate seats has alerted people to some of the dangers implicit in that kind of reaction against the major parties.
Corinne Hunter contested the seat of Griffith at the September poll for the Palmer United Party, which won a Senate seat in Queensland. She's told AM, at this stage, she's not running again, but she says the party is still in discussions about whether to recontest the seat. Either way, there'll be a new face representing Griffith, but the presence of Kevin Rudd is, so far, proving hard to shake.
The Rudd bike program, Kevin gave away nearly 900 push bikes to schools and community groups, and I can tell you I get a lot of questions about whether I'll keep doing that.
Labor candidate Terry Butler ending that report by Melissa Clark. Just about every state except Tasmania experienced heatwave conditions around New Year. Now West Australians are preparing for temperatures close to 50 degrees. Inland regions will be worst affected, and there are concerns that fly-in, fly-out mining workers and others may not be prepared for the heat. AM's Caitlin Gribben reports.
Inland Australia has been scorched by extreme temperatures in recent days. Now, very hot weather is forecast for WA. For people like Lynn Craigie, who live in the state's Pilbara, that means temperatures in at least the mid-40s.
Blisteringly hot, and you learn to stay inside. The things I think that people that don't live there wouldn't be aware of is you can't go outside and just touch the railing as you walk into the shopping centre. It will be red hot. Your car steering wheel will be red hot, your seat belts, and people can get quite significant burns from simply getting into their car.
The chair of the Pilbara Regional Council is hoping WA residents will take the extreme temperatures seriously. Over the next week, inland towns like Marble Bar are forecast to hit 48 degrees. Mark Paul is from the Bureau of Meteorology.
Basically, everywhere's going to get pretty warm. Certainly up in through the Pilbara and parts of the Gascoyne, you'll see temperatures hovering right up at the very high end of the 40-degree mark.
Lynn Craigie says the temperatures are most worrying for people employed in the region's massive mining industry.
Especially for workers who come into the Pilbara on a short-term basis, not just fly-in, fly-out workers in mining, but also builders who are coming up, people who might have come over from overseas to do a short stint. They find 35 degrees is hot and will be stripping off their shirt, can get very sunburnt, very dehydrated very, very quickly.
The Bureau's Mark Paul says Perth is forecast for late 30s and up to 40 degrees this week. Parts of WA's wheat belt will hit 45.
You're going to see the conditions warm up right through the end of the week into the weekend and probably even Monday as well. Looks like a fairly solid week. By Monday, you might see a bit of a humid change on the west coast again and then basically possibly starting to warm up.
And while some West Australians will struggle in the heat, Lynn Craigie says most locals in the north are used to it.
Most of us have a bottle of water tucked away in the boot of the car for those emergencies, but it's very common to find people who are out there who break down who haven't got it. And of course, you don't last a long time without water in those conditions.
Will there be a few at the pub when the temperatures are getting close to 50?
I'd like to say, yes, it's a great place to go, but of course, people are restricted by what they can drink and still work. And also, alcohol is not a great energiser when you're dehydrated. So we try and encourage people to drink more of your salty drinks and water.
Lynn Craigie from the WA Pilbara Regional Council. Caitlin Gribben, our reporter there. To the financial markets, the Dow Jones isn't doing much. In late trade, it was down 8 points. The dollar is buying 89.6 US cents, 93.4 Japanese yen, 65.7 euro cents. I'm Tony Eastley. It's 7:30.